Welcome. So this is the fourth night of Buddhism in a Nutshell. We're going to cover bodhicitta in just a bit. I want to show, as part of a review, a short video on karma. That hopefully will work, Chris. Can everyone hear that?
Ask the question, who made me? The Buddha says very directly, you did. So this concept that we have, not physical, doesn't have a lot of water, doesn't have a lot of fat. Your body did, no problem. Egg and sperm, no problem. Sperm is a nice body of yours. How kind of mother and father provide the body, you know? But who you are, your personality, your characteristics, your propensities, your love, your hate, your anger, your jealousy, your pride, your craziness, your intelligence, whatever, doesn't come from mother and father. Just because we're like them doesn't mean that they gave it to us, you know? So consciousness, this beginningless, not created, doesn't just come from nowhere. It's not some random event that just pops up out of the sky, you know? Isn't physical, not created. This is a central point of that mind. And in a way, for a Buddhist or a person even wanting to understand Buddhism, the being here these words is kind of crucial for an understanding of how you practice and how you develop. And all, you know, all of Buddhist teachings come, you know, are based on this concept, actually. Everything we say, do, or think, the Buddhist term, is a karma, if you like. Like everything you do, say, or think is like a seed that you're planting in your consciousness. It will bring a fruit similar to that seed. But all karma is not an explanation of why. That's all. It's simply a technical explanation of why you get harm, you get love, whatever the story is. I mean, it's a heavy-duty idea, but it's very empowering because it says, I can change it.
Force, their increasing force, and you generate a strong determination that you're not going to engage in those actions again in the next day. So this is a very important practice to be taken in your hand. In brief, what should be done all the time is to practice awareness of the three dots of the body, speech, and mind. When you are alone, practice awareness of the mind. What's going on in my mind right now? Is my mind going into virtuous or non-virtuous? And while recognizing that the mind is going into non-virtuous, apply the openness, the opening powers, that particular non-virtuous, and bring back the mind to virtuous. And while you find yourself with others, you should mainly apply awareness in your speech. Actually, for those who want to be happy, even while experiencing great mental hardships, all they have to do is to place confidence in the karma. Then you know that suffering comes as a result of previously accumulated actions. If I have accumulated particular actions myself, nobody else is going to experience the result but myself. Therefore, by experiencing this particular result right now, I'm actually getting rid of a huge load of negative karma that I've accumulated in the past. And that itself serves to clear completely the mind from any hardships, even at time of incredible difficulties.
You say virtuous is non-virtuous. This translation is a little difficult to follow.
Certainly, I at least have to follow my attachment. I have to follow my desire, and therefore I create negative karma. It's a negative action, puts a negative imprint in my mind. In order to get this little moment of worldly happiness, I create the potential for suffering in the future. Practicing the law of cause and effect is the key to developing every quality on the path to liberation and enlightenment. So that is the fundamental refuge. Understanding the law of cause and effect, developing faith in it, putting a key emphasis to being mindful of the law of cause and effect in our daily life so that we can observe it. It's one of the Sri Rinpoche makes this joke, just ordinary mindfulness is not good enough. You know, now I'm picking up the knife, now I'm stabbing this person very carefully. That kind of mindfulness is not helpful. Real mindfulness has this moral connotation of knowing, being aware that what one is doing something that is either virtuous or non-virtuous. Knowing that this thing is going to produce suffering now and in the future, or this action of body, speech or mind is going to produce some happiness now and in the future. We need that kind of mindfulness. Mindfulness mixed with an understanding and faith in the law of cause and effect. And the stronger the faith, the stronger the energy to withhold from doing negative things, thinking negative things, saying negative things, and doing negative things. And also the more we understand the law of cause and effect, we develop a deeper understanding of what is negative, what is harmful to ourselves. So that is the key teaching, the key practice.
Venerable Amy Miller teaches here every year. She was just here weekend before last.
Fast-paced environment. When you're in Washington, D.C., part of your work and in politics is people lie, and that's part of your business, is to lie. In fact, you are encouraged to lie, and you are you're rewarded for lying.
Did you see this?
In some workplaces where I didn't think people listened to me. And For 2 years, I very seriously went after the lie. I was very careful in my relationship not to lie, and I was very careful in work, in business conduct with people that I wouldn't lie. And after like 2 or 3 years, something started to change, and I felt people were listening, and people did believe me. It started to really change my world. They say that sometimes when you change your ethical behavior by speaking the truth, by cultivating life and helping, you know, to save lives and freeing animals and being respectful in my relationships with people, particularly intimate relationships cultivating harmony in them and trying to practice taking care of my possessions and treating other possessions with respect to if I borrow something. And all these things of right speech, you know, speaking the truth and really trying to use my speech meaningfully, not gossiping all the time and not criticizing people and judging people and not kind of dividing people in speech and trying to have positive thoughts about things. I noticed that things changed. When you wake up in the morning, you have two choices. You can have a good day or you can have a bad day. And even when bad things happen to you, depending on your reaction to them, you know, you could say, bad thing happened to me today. But you know, I'm not going to get angry at my friend because that's just going to create the situation of anger to come back at me. You know, when you start to understand it that way, then you stop reacting. Why did they do this to me? This is not fair. There's no, with karma, there's no more injustice. Things might look like it's not fair, but basically it's something you've created. So the nice thing with karma is it puts you at the controls. There isn't anybody doing it to you. You're not a victim. You're basically in charge of what kind of seeds you'd like to plant from here on out. So by watching my activities, the activities really my body, speech, and mind, I feel like that's going to create a good chance for me.
Similar to that of a business plan. You know, if your forecast, you know, if your plan, you know, doesn't have a proper foundation, then all your forecasting is going to go off. It's just not going to succeed. I realize then I better look at what are the problems I'm facing in the company, and then I better look at what seeds I planted in the past, you know, because all my suffering has come from a core. The major problem we had was inventory, pilferage, stock pilferage and losses. And so, you know, every year, you know, merchandise, clothing, you know, people steal them from our warehouse, from our shop, and we don't know about it till the end of the year when we look and we say, oh my God, so many goods are missing, you know. So then I realized by looking at the teachings that, through investigation, you know, I realized the cause of that was stealing. Now you say, now how does stealing have to do with losing inventory? But then stealing can mean many things also, you know. And I realized that sometimes our company does not pay on time, you know. So by delaying payment could be considered also stealing. So when I realized that, I said to myself, this must change. So we had to renegotiate with our suppliers to get longer credit terms. And then honor those due dates that we said we would meet. You see? So that was what we had to apply, that antidote, so that we could stop the cause of more further losses and further pilferage. You see? So something had to be done. We had to do it straight away. So this was the answer we thought we would have to do. The result of that, since 2 years ago, is that our inventory losses have come down, you see? So this really shows me that, you know, Buddha's teachings do work. The more that I see that happening, it really inspires me to study Dharma. Because that way, you know what, you can change your life. You know, I could change my life, you know? If I didn't like the causes of, if I didn't like what's going on, you know, Buddhism is kind. It allows you to change. But you know, so that you can create your own happiness. But you need to understand that you're creating your own suffering. I needed to understand that I was creating my own suffering. Nobody was doing it to me. with myself, my causes from the past. And I could say that, well, you know, I don't think I did that. I don't think I did that. If my memory cannot even remember 6 months ago, then how can I remember all the bad deeds I've done 10 years ago, 20 years ago? I don't. But the point is, I've created this garden. It's got a lot of weeds, you know? So I have to spend my time weeding, purification, collecting merit, studying teaching, and devoting myself to the Dhamma, all things that will create more happiness. And then by me being happy, then I can benefit sentient beings, because they are happy to be working in the company. They're happy because they say, you know, things are going well and they will be rewarded too. So everybody benefits.
So that was, we talked about a lot of those issues last week. Do you remember the when we talked about karma, how it expands? If it's not dealt with, if it doesn't ripen or it's not purified, then it just it expands, increases. Susie has a practice every day where she does Vajrasattva practice. It's a purification practice. So discussion, questions about any of that, what you saw in the video? Student, I thought was, I wouldn't normally include that because it kind of got long, but it's a very practical viewpoint of karma. This, she owned a shop and she was saying inventory. You know, some of her pronunciations are difficult to understand, but we don't always think of karma as having such an immediate effect. It's generally, we generally think of it as something that's going to ripen in the future.
Very, very far out.
So she had a, Tara had a viewpoint where this was affecting her daily. And of course, I think that's, you know, clearly we see that in our own lives. If you're in our workplace or in our family, if we're rude or we're angry, people are going to avoid us. You know, nobody wants to be around an unhappy person. And when you're glad to see people and you're always smiling and so forth, people are attracted to you. So there's a real practical aspect to karma in that way. Any questions about any of that? Sure.
Sorry, I wasn't here last week, but she spoke to purification.
Yes, oh, it's a directional. There you go.
She spoke to purification,
yes.
Seeing teachings and merits. I mean, what? I guess I missed some of that.
Sure. And it would be real easy to go through that those slides. So, and again, this is a review. We can do it really quickly. Karma just means action. It's just not. It's a Sanskrit word, cause and effect. So everything we do is either virtuous or non-virtuous, as opposed to good or bad. So, and this thing, it's not working either. I'm so sorry that this, we're technically challenged here recently. This was what Venerable Tubin was talking about, how nothing comes into being without a cause. Again, karma is a really convenient way to explain all of the Buddhist teachings. All of the Buddhist teachings are included in karma. So I made this slide to show how the Four Noble Truths can be viewed from the aspect of karma. So the Four Noble Truths, of course, are the truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, the truth of sensation of suffering, and the truth of the path. So if you look at this chart, the number two, the origin of suffering, causes the number one, causes suffering, the truth of suffering. The truth of the path is a cause for the sensation of suffering. That's the truth of the sensation of the Fourth Noble Truth. I had some formatting issues. I don't know why those are in different fonts. Let me see. Yes. Okay, I'm trying to get to purification. So these are the 10 non-virtuous actions that Venerable Amy Miller was talking about, the killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. And the fourth of speech, the fourth of speech, it is not just lying. It's also, as you see, slander. It's also gossiping. I mean, in that you're gossiping, that you're wasting people's time in gossiping. And this three of mind, you know, when I was first learning about karma, I was so disappointed that karma can be a thought. So I was like, I'm pretty good about not creating non-virtuous karma with my body, or saying things, you know, killing things, you know. And then I see, you know, that actually your thoughts can be non-virtuous.
What is wrong
views? So you could, I think a more accurate, instead of wrong, is wise. And it's going to be, that's in regards to emptiness and into how things exist. A wrong view is to the assumption that everything exists the way it appears, okay. That everything inherently exists inherently from its own side, or without a previous cause or condition. That's a wrong view, to assume that things exist without a prior cause and condition. And so here we're also including this idea of consciousness in our discussions of karma and rebirth. Again, all of these issues are explained in karma. The consciousness is not physical. It can only be produced by something that's non-physical. I mean, we understand that the brain being blood and tissue and so on, that clearly is physical. But consciousness is not. This our awareness that we have is not physical. And we're going to talk about that more next week. And we just went over this, they talked about this in the video. So here's your purifications, and I have a handout that I didn't bring. So the first one, of course, is that we don't. There's no guilt in Buddhism, but there is certainly regret. I wish I had not done that. We usually quickly realize when there is a non-virtuous action that's causing some people to suffer. Reliance on the teachings. The monk Rupa, I can't ever pronounce his name, but the one that didn't speak English, he was talking about every day review your actions of the day and rejoice in those virtuous actions, and then the non-virtuous actions, be aware of your regret, be aware of how you can have refuge and reliance in the teachings, and the remedies for, I'm not going to do that again, I'm aware of how I acted, or I'm aware of how I generated this non-virtuous action, and I'm the remedy is that I'm aware of it, and then I'm going to resolve not to do those things again. And again, this is a way of dealing with our non-virtuous actions in a positive way, as opposed to being depressed or sad or upset with ourselves because we generated this non-virtuous action. Does that help? Okay. Yes, Susie.
I was going to say, who was the monk that you said was talking?
He is...
Just his name. Well, the monk...
Rupa Rinpoche, R.
Oh, not him, but another one.
Oh, the Thubten Dundrum The Australian teacher?
Yeah. Well, the Australian monk, when he said you could do something and you can choose between actions, and I could have taken that wrong if I didn't know more, that you can't do fun things. In fact, on Sunday, Geshe-la was talking about it's fine to enjoy things. The trick is to not get attached to it so that you always have to have it, or some people have to have their coffee. You can enjoy your coffee, but you don't have to become a horror if you don't get your coffee. Just a simple example.
Trying to go to my next slide, so...
And I can also say on the four opponent powers, there are many practices, or there are a number of practices that you can learn about. But just even the idea of going through it in your mind is very helpful.
The three principal aspects of the path is a teaching by Lama Tsongkhapa. When we talk about the Four Noble Truths, that fourth noble truth, the truth of the path, this is what we're talking about. This is Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of this school, of the Gelugpa school, also started the tradition of the Dalai Lamas. He trained in the first Dalai Lama and established that lineage of Dalai Lamas. He's represented by these statues here with the gold hats. So we're like the gold hat tradition. And some of them are quite humorous. So in the first one, in the renunciation, we talked about that in discussing the Four Noble Truths, karma, samsara. What we're renouncing is attachment to those things. We are renouncing our existing in this cycle of birth, old age, death, and sickness. I'm losing my voice. So in this renunciation, like Susie's talking about, we're not talking about giving up your chocolate cake. We're not talking about giving up things that make you that you enjoy in life. There are many deliciousness, many things that are delicious in samsara. There are many things that are delicious in this human existence. What we're saying in renunciation is that we understand that these things that we are enjoying can become a source of suffering if we become attached to them, if we become if we cling to things, and that we've used things like chocolate cake as an example, or cheesecake, that, you know, that first piece is delicious, that third, fourth, fifth, sixth piece might not be so delicious, and that's an example that we use. So that's what we're talking about in renunciation. So tonight we're going to talk about bodhicitta. This is the core of the Mahayana tradition. This is the essence of Tibetan Buddhism. Bodhicitta is the altruistic wish to become enlightened to benefit everyone else. Now, this is a pretty amazing concept, and I've just blurted it out as though it's this really simple thing. So, bodhicitta. So, citta is mind. Bodhi is enlightened. So it's the enlightened mind that seeks to benefit all sentient beings. Now, there are a few methods that Lama Tsongkhapa and others developed to learn and deal with this. So before you could wish to be enlightened to benefit all beings, all sentient beings, all beings that can feel pain, you're going to have to understand and accept that this idea of equanimity. And we do this by comparing these three ideas: friend, enemy, and stranger. So An example of friend, anybody. You just shouted out, Susie, friend.
You.
Thank you. But it's generally someone that pleases you, someone that you enjoy being around. That's someone that oftentimes a friend is yeah. Well, I mean, it's someone you enjoy being around. I mean, there's this long explanation. I'm trying to remember this. You know, it's like three paragraphs. It's not coming to me. An enemy. I mean, we're all understand that this is someone who's done us harm, someone that wishes us harm, someone that talks about us, lies to us, steals from us. You know, there's any number of ways to describe enemy. And then stranger, again, this is someone we don't know, someone we don't have an opinion about. When we think of the three of these, our friend was at one time a stranger. Certainly. Our spouses, strangers. Oftentimes, an enemy used to be a friend. It certainly was a stranger. So we have this meditation on equanimity. It takes a long time. I've been in classes where we do it, and I enjoy it, but I'm not the best leader of meditation. So, but the idea is that you imagine like three chairs and sitting in front of you, and you have imagine that there's a friend sitting in one chair. Imagine that there's an enemy. I mean, a real person, someone that you have an adverse opinion of, someone that you, when they come in the room, you just tighten up. So this is a real person you're imagining. And then a stranger, someone that you just pick out from the mall, the airport. And then practice swapping these around, remembering when that enemy was a stranger. Maybe it's a new job, you saw this person, and when you first saw them, you thought, well, that, you know, they seem to be nice enough, and then you find out that they're trying to steal your job, they're lying about you so that they can get promoted and so on. We all know those things, they steal your parking spot. But when you first saw that person, they were a stranger. So, and the same thing with friend. And sometimes these all can swap back and forth. Friend and enemy sometimes can swap back and forth. You know, you forgive them. We all come in to group hug, and then they're being mean to you again. So the idea I'm trying to get across is that before you can be a bodhisattva, before you can have this altruistic wish, this altruistic desire to become enlightened, to benefit all sentient beings, you've got to think of everyone as a friend, as one of the examples we use is as your mother. Now this is not always easy for people. So this is called, this is Tibetan. This is from the Lama Tsongkhapa, and you'll see this in other traditions as well. Sometimes it's seven causes and effects, but the way it's taught in the Gelug tradition is six causes and one effect. So the first cause of bodhicitta, we're talking about again, this idea of becoming enlightened to benefit other people, is to recognize all beings as your mother. Now, from the Buddhist perspective, there's rebirth. See, we talked about karma. We talked about how this, where rebirth comes from is this idea of how consciousness exists. One moment of consciousness, this present moment of consciousness was preceded by a prior moment of consciousness and so on. Without beginning, without end. That's what the Buddhist posit. And if that's true, then we've all been each other's mothers. We've all been each other's fathers. We've all been each other's siblings. And so this is a way, understanding that this idea is that because of rebirth, that everyone has been each other's mother. So in just accept that for a moment, that everyone has been each other's mother. Let's think a moment about the kindness that our mother has shown us. Now, everyone has had a good relationship with their mother. I did. I've met people that haven't. I've met people that didn't know their mother and so on. But so if you didn't have a good relationship with your mother, imagine someone that you did, someone that you did have a positive relationship. That kindness that your mother showed you cannot compare to anything else. Taught you how to walk, taught you how to eat, cared for you when you're just a peanut. And so the third cause of this effect is the wish to repay the kindness that your mother showed you, paying it forward. This warming love, and these actually have the kind of love that a mother feels when looking at her only child. Now we're talking about you having this emotion for a complete stranger walking down the mall. In this number four, this heartwarming love, here you generate the same kind of affectionate love towards all sentient beings, perceiving all beings in a beautiful and glowing way. That's a lot for that one line there. Compassion. I mean, we all know what compassion is. The way it's described in the sutras is, what is the measure or sign of having generated great compassion in your mind? It is that you feel towards all beings the same wish for them to be free of suffering that a mother would feel for her only child. The compassion that they're talking about is the compassion a mother would have for a two-year-old child, their two-year-old child, that was getting ready to walk off a cliff. It's 15 feet away. You can't get to it. It's getting ready to step off the edge of a cliff. That compassion. And having that compassion for someone you don't know, the stranger. Firm intention. We all, we set our intention at the beginning of each one of these classes. When we study karma, we talk about the importance of volition, the intent behind action. And the way this intention is described, this is extraordinary intention because it's similar to being in the position of saving someone from falling off a cliff. Well, there you go. And that you're responsible for saving that person. So the effect of these six causes is bodhicitta. Discussions, questions about any of that?
Going back to karma?
Sure.
So if we're asking at night to be forgiven for maybe something from a long time ago, is the only way to do that through prayer, or is there some intentions you should, some works you should be doing, or?
Well, that's several questions there. And the first one is the implication that there's something or someone to answer prayer from. Growing up in the West and growing up in Christian or Judeo traditions, we all have had that. Most all of us have had that training. In Buddhism, there's no God. There's no creator. Buddha was just a normal person, had these skills, developed his mind. So the prayers that we do in Buddhism are aspirations. There, prayers are training our mind to be compassionate, training our mind to wish other people to be, other beings to be free from suffering. So that time that you spend alone in meditation, prayerfully wishing that others are free from their suffering, is going to purify your own non-virtuous actions. Is that fair, Jim? So, Susie, is that yeah. Yeah.
Yeshua can do it.
Yes. 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 So much of this can be very practical. It's like Rinpoche was talking about the end of the day, reviewing your actions for that day, identifying what you did well and what you did not do well, identifying the things that you handled skillfully and the things that you did not do skillfully. That is training yourself. That is training your mind to be skillful in the future. Yes, Susie? Thank you. Thank you.
If you don't mind, it would be that you would forgive yourself.
That's what I was going to fix, blurred out.
Thank you. Good.
Okay,
good. I was going to ask you, it seemed like if you can't forgive yourself,
if
you can't forgive yourself, nobody else can forgive you.
Thank you for that. So the first, when you're developing this altruistic intention to become enlightened to benefit all sentient beings, you start with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You start with yourself. It's like wanting to be a lifeguard at the pool but not knowing how to swim. So somebody's drowning in the deep end and you haven't learned to swim yet. So the first is compassion for yourself. It starts with yourself. It starts with yourself. Having the same loving kindness for yourself that your mother did, that your mother had for you. Each one of those six causes is talking about yourself first.
And after you forgive yourself, I mean, sometimes people go back to it over and over every night. But the idea is to say, I forgive myself, and here's what I'm going to do about it. My next step is to be a better person, is to do this little thing, and little by little. Is that right, Steve?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I just want to make sure I don't want to teach your class, but...
No, thank you. So this idea of bodhicitta, the question arises, you know, am I capable of this? I mean, it's the first, you know, what skills do I have to save people? I mean, this is what they're saying, is saving people, rescuing them from their suffering, their spring. And I think the first thing you could imagine is that probably today I'm not a bodhisattva, but understanding that Buddha's, becoming a Buddha is what's going to be required to become a bodhisattva, to develop bodhicitta. Now we have bodhicitta vows. I have taken those. I've taken lay vows. I've taken, you know, refuge vows and lay vows. And I'm not sure I'm there yet, to be honest. Questions about that? Yes, please.
Well, basically, every single day you should be striving to achieve bodhicitta.
Every moment.
Okay. Right.
So an example. I could leave this class and stop by the food line on my way home, get a quart of ice cream and a bag of cookies. I'm in the express lane and there's a lady there with a grocery cart overflowing with stuff. There's one clerk in the whole store and they're working the express lane and I'm behind this lady. My ice cream's melted. But if you were bodhicitta, if you had bodhicitta, you'd be happy that this woman was able to get in line in front of you. You would rejoice in that. How hard is that, Wendy? How hard is that? The traffic light. You know, the light turns green, they're still sitting there. You know?
That's
what you
need, right speech, do you?
Yeah.
Right honking.
So, Venerable Amy Miller example. Imagine that you are going to meet a friend you haven't seen in a long time, going to Panera Bread at North Hills. You've got your tea, coffee, whatever your beverage is. You've got in your car, you've got your coffee, you've got your music playing, your favorite station, favorite CD. You get on the belt line, you're going around this friend you haven't seen in ages. So they're looking forward to this, seeing this friend. And this car comes in the on-ramp and cuts you off. And you slam on brakes, you spill your tea, skidding your tires, your CD jumps. Daggone it, you're going to pull up beside that person and give them the finger. And when you pull up and look over there, it's your mom. Bodhicitta. If you had bodhicitta when you got in the car, it had never occurred to you. Your concern would have been for the other car. You know, they weren't paying attention. Where were they going? And if it really was your mom, whose car is she driving? Why is she not paying attention? that same concern that you would have when you see, when you look at it and you see it's your mom, the same concern you would have for that, for your mom, bodhicitta is having that for a stranger, having that same compassion, that same concern for the stranger. It's powerful. Please, Susie.
I thought you were going to give a different example.
Okay.
I love that one.
Well, give yours.
It's she noticed that when she was in the airport, people were rejoicing seeing their relatives coming, and she started looking at strangers and saying, oh, they're great. They got off the plane. Everything looks good. She was rejoicing for people she didn't know. And it ended up, I don't want to speak for her, but I think she said it ended up being a great feeling.
Well, see, Stephanie has an example. Stephanie Stevens, she was went to the airport to pick up her mother, and the secure area was at the below an escalator, so she couldn't go past the secure area to get the elevator. She was standing there watching the elevator, and this lady would get on the elevator, that's not my mother. This other person would get on, that's not my mother. This other people, that's not my mother. And she got to thinking, Stephanie got to thinking. Do you remember that
maybe
story?
Maybe it was Stephanie instead of the Venerable Amy. I probably is Stephanie.
Well, see, Stephanie could be quoting Venerable Amy.
Whatever. It's a good story.
Yeah, and so she goes through this whole process again, seeing all these different people and just meditating on, that's my mother, that was my mother, that was my mother, that was my mother. So, Chris, you haven't said much? Questions, comments, observations? Bodhicitta. So this is the second of the three principal aspects of the path. Again, this is the core of Mahayana Buddhism. When we've talked about the three Buddhist schools, Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, the Hinayana's personal liberation. It's not a derogatory term, although it can sound that way. The Hinayana tradition is the you have to become enlightened, you have to become aware, you have to have renunciation. It's kind of like the bottom steps of a ladder. To get to the Mahayana, to become bodhicitta, you've got to start somewhere. I mean, you guys didn't come in here to benefit every sentient being in the world. You came here to learn something about yourself. I mean, we all did. We all do. I still do. This is my practice. So, but bodhicitta is the essence of Tibetan Buddhism. And I've probably got some long-winded slides when I sit here and try to decide what to talk about. There's a prayer that I'm supposed to teach. It's the foundation of all good qualities. Every stanza in the foundation of all good qualities describes every aspect of the path from the Four Noble Truths and renunciation to emptiness. So this was written in the 1300s. If you can get the whole prayer if you go to the Kadampa website, Kadampa-media, and you click on spiritual programs, there's a button that says Buddhism in a Nutshell, and then there's like 8 or 9 handouts, and this is one. So again, in the 1300s, so 650 years ago. So praying to be able to free all sentient beings. I don't understand the migratory word. Do you, Jim? Do you know why they use that? Why he used that?
Just being reborn.
Yeah. 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 Lama Tsongkhapa. That's how you pronounce it. T is silent. Tsongkhapa. Sounds like I'm saying a whole lot. So Rinpoche was talking about bodhicitta without the morality, you know, stabbing someone mindfully. So this idea of bodhicitta, what the assertion here is not possible without a a foundation in morals and ethics. So the three types of morality in this poem, I think I have another slide. Nope, I'm running out of slides. So the three types of morality in this, as relates to this prayer, is refraining from negative activities of body, speech, and mind, the three doors, morality of accomplishing virtue and performing virtuous actions, and then the morality of working for the benefit of sentient beings. And I don't think I've been taught that until I was preparing these slides. I didn't know that what that was. So, that's a lot to think about. So questions, discussion. So that in the Buddhist tradition, this discussion, the reason I keep asking for questions is it's the way we all learn. We ask questions, we teach each other. I learn from your questions. Sometimes I'm asked questions that I don't know the answer to, so that's something I have to go out and learn for the next time. Or comments.
I was...
Oh, good.
Good. Anybody? It is a lot.
Steve?
Yes, please. So this is all streamed and uploaded to YouTube. It's why we use the microphone.
So you mentioned that you had taken the Bodhisattva vows.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So at what point does that happen in your progression of...
It's entirely up to the individual. We're all in a different path.
I am.
Yeah. I was present when Chris took his. Chris took them. Mm-hmm. Yes, Lisa.
So when is it and how is it determined that you're ready for a certain level?
Good. And they encouraged us to talk about ourselves, our own experience. I came to Kadampa by happenstance. I was taking online courses. I'd taken several Buddhist courses from college, some college level. I was looking for another online course. And FPMT, our umbrella organization, has all these teachings are available online. So I was taking Discovering Buddhism, a two-year course, online. As I was logging into the classroom portal, I noticed on the toolbar was a button that said Centers. And I clicked on that, and there was one in Raleigh. I had no idea there'd be one in Raleigh. There's only 13 in the United States. 18. 18 in the United States. One of 18. Yeah. Yeah. And so I live in Cary. I was here the next day. And so I came here for a couple of years just for my own benefit. I mean, I got the Bodhicitta. I understood that it's important to... you can't be happy and angry at the same time. I mean, so much of it was just common sense and made sense to me. But it was because of Geshe-la that I took refuge vows. And when I showed our lineage of teachers that starts with Geshe Tsongkhapa, Geshe Gelug, the two resident monks that we have here, Tibetan monks. Geshe Tsongkhapa escaped from Tibet at 12. Went to the monastery. In the monastery, graduated with a Geshe Longrompa degree, PhD with honors, and Geshe Gelug in the monastery, age 7. And he's Longrompa. That's with honors. So cum laude. I just had a real connection to Geshe Gelug, and when I learned about the refuge vow, so. To become a Buddhist, you would take these vows to refuge vows in the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is the historical figure, not him as a person, but his accomplishments. You know, that he's this regular person that using only his mind, the only instrument he had to explore these, this, suffering that he saw in the world. The only instrument he had was his mind. And so through meditation, he tuned and calibrated, so to speak, his mind, just like a scientist with a microscope or a telescope. And to have, I think it's inspiring to know that this gifted, intellectually gifted, but human person, human being, was able to accomplish what he did. I take refuge in that. That in some life, I will be able to do that. We all have Buddha nature. We all have the ability to become Buddhists. We all will become Buddhists eventually. The Dharma is a Sanskrit word that means that which upholds. So it's not Buddha Dharma. It's a Dharma that upholds the Buddha's teachings. All of the Buddha's teachings, the canons, the sutras, the scripture, so to speak, what the Buddha taught, and then the practices, the rituals that we have here, that's the Dharma. And so taking refuge in that, in those teachings, in those traditions, in those rituals. And then the Sangha in the East, in Asia, Sangha is just the Buddhist and the monks and nuns generally. In the West, we consider the Sangha our community, the people, other practitioners. And so, you know, Jim and Susie and Chris and I we're each other's Sangha, so to speak. And so I take refuge in that they are on a path similar to mine. It's parallel in many ways. And so in the refuge ceremony that you would take with a accomplished teacher, you vow that when you have issues, that you are going to take refuge in those three things. And I saw that as a powerful enabler for me, as opposed to casually practicing, reading casually, you know, in other words, not having a set pattern of practice. Taking those vows helps me when I'm annoyed with the lady in the express lane with the basket full. That's where I get my ability to appreciate her suffering, her issues. So I converted. I mean, I was baptized as a child. Never really practiced that. I mean, my parents were very involved and very devout Christians, but they just didn't, for reasons I would bore you, it just didn't take with me. And so after I'd been coming here for a couple of years, and I saw that as a aspect of this practice, that actually converted to Buddhism and took those vows with Geshe. And he gives you you get a Buddhist name, a Tibetan name, Mine's Lobsang Dawa. Noble Moon. But it's a very common name. It's like Joe Smith. It really is a very common name. Both, and Lobsang is both male and female. I've seen it both in both genders. That was a long explanation. Okay, Wendy, thank you.
Makes sense to me.
Okay, thank you. We have a question there. Okay.
It's for me, because we don't live here close by, so
sure,
we can't always come to things. But I guess the hardest thing I have to do is what meditations to do.
Yes.
Especially just starting now. I mean, I know how to do the breathing meditation,
okay,
but beyond that, I don't know what the next step is, and I don't know really. I feel kind of lost. Would it be helpful
good
to come,
yes,
here on Sundays?
Yes.
And
yes.
Do the,
so yeah. So, and we have a meditation. When did you say the next meditation class was, Susie? So you know that these.
And I was looking up the next Discovering Buddhism for you in September.
So these classes rotate, these beginner classes, there's Meditation 101 alternates with Buddhism in a Nutshell. So it's every it's Tuesday nights, and so we have 5 nights of this and then a break, and then 5 nights of meditation and then a break. Now, some teachers, a lot of the teachers in Buddhism in a nutshell do teach meditation, and they begin classes with meditation, and we do, some do the meditation on equanimity. I'm not good at that. You know, I just, you know, and I'm inspired to be better at it, but did you have some dates?
That's Meditation 101 at night is September 4th, and it's 5 nights.
Do you know who's teaching it? Anybody?
Oh, no. Once a week on Tuesday. Who's teaching that one?
Oh, he's great. Yeah, that's a good teacher. Very good teacher. I might come to that. So there's guided meditations in Venerable Amy Miller's book. There's a CD in the back. It's an 11-hour CD. There's a bunch of meditations. And she does the meditations on equanimity, where you're exchanging friend and enemy and stranger and so on, emptiness and
beautiful voice.
She it's a very calming voice. It's interesting because we know her pretty, I say well. I mean, we've been students of hers, and she's taught here. And she stays with, when she comes to teach, she stays with Elise and David Strebel, and we always have a tea there to visit with her. So her voice is very familiar to me. But this video was made in 2003. So she was like maybe 40. Now she's 60, 45, I don't know. But anyway, 15 years ago, this DVD was made. So, but her voice is exactly the same. And so in this audio CD, she does have that very calming voice, that very reassuring, easy to listen to voice.
There's also a book out there, How to Meditate, you might consider.
And so did you get the posture, meditation posture handout? I have one left. I passed those out the first night.
And they're all online.
They're all online.
I mean, not to discourage you from getting one, but they're all online. Do you need?
You're welcome. Jim, anything to add?
No. Good ways to get started, I'm sure. And you mentioned coming on Sundays to listen to guests. That's always good. There's always, you know, regardless of what level you're at, you know, if you've never come before, you can just walk in the door and just sit and listen to them, and you're going to go away with something. Yeah. Don't be afraid to come, you know, and feel you don't have enough background.
And that's every Sunday, isn't it, basically?
Yes.
You can look online again on Facebook or on the website, and you'll get an idea. But Kimberly was asking about where Venerable Amy learned things, and I was trying. What can you tell them about India, FPMT, Lama Zopa?
So yes. So Kadampa Center is affiliated with the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, FPMT. That is was founded by Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. It's these two gentlemen on either side of His Holiness in the back. I don't know if you can see around the screen. So in the 60s and 70s, my generation was going to Asia to study meditation. And you know, some of my generation were experimenting with mind-enhancing substances. Timothy Leary was one. You might have heard of him. Timothy Leary and Ram Dass. So many people, and the Beatles were going to India studying transcendental meditation. So all these hippies, as Geshe-la says, were showing up in Nepal and Kathmandu and different monasteries in Asia with their bell bottoms. He didn't know what the word was for bell bottoms. He kept holding up his pants, and he was doing like this. But, you know, that generation. And so Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe thought, well, instead of having all these Westerners come to India, we should go to North America and teach. So they did. They started coming here in the early 70s, and they established one or two centers. They would teach one teacher, and then that teacher would teach other teachers, and they would travel back and forth. And those centers multiplied and became the FPMT. So there are about 160 worldwide, and they're all over Europe, North America, South America, Australia, New Zealand. I took a course that's called The Foundation of Buddhist Thought. It's a two-year online course, and my classmates, there were like 18 people in my module, were from Spain, Belarus. It was an amazing experience. And all of that comes from Lama Zopen, Lama Rinpoche. Venerable Amy was in Nepal, I don't remember for what reason, and we have a monastery, Kopan Monastery, and that's in Nepal. That's where Dr. Brown and Dr. Watkins first were exposed to the Dharma.
Dr. Brown
founded the center 25 years ago in his living room through the encouragement of Lama Yeshin, Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Then they moved to the basement of the office building, and we bought this. We own, we have a mortgage. We own this building, but that was another long answer. Another long explanation. Did that explain very much?
I didn't catch where she said she practiced. Everybody else was saying Tibet, and hers was different.
She lives in Philadelphia. Her father's elderly, and she's been living with him. But she travels. She teaches all over the world. She was here 2 weeks ago for the Nyingma, the week-long retreat that they did here. Did you do that?
I did.
Okay. She also leads retreats to Ladau in the Himalayas. How you say it?
Ladau,
yeah. We have these other teachers in our lineage, Asanga, these famous teachers that meditated for years.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah, this was hundreds of years ago. Venerable Amy does leads those retreats, and a group of us are going to India in November with Geshe Sangpo, and all of the nuns now are going. Lamala, yeah, all of the nuns, all Chukala's go, Chukala, Lamala. So we're going to live in Sarajay Monastery for a week, and then we're going to fly to Delhi. We'll spend a week in Bodh Gaya. So that's all through the center.
I don't know if you were getting at this, but back in the 70s, there weren't that many teachings that were translated.
Oh, yeah.
And so we're very fortunate. A lot of the books that we have out here in English are pretty recent in the scope of time. You know, so you're not that far behind. But she was there, and then they asked her to go elsewhere. So she learned there, and
yes, yeah. So Buddhism is fairly recent in the West. So the words Buddhist and Buddhism does not appear in textbooks until the 1700s. So the Asians, the practitioners at the time of the Buddha and the time of some of these teachers, Nagarjuna and Asanga and some of these people, there was no word, there was the Buddha, even Sanskrit for awaken, but there was no word for Buddhism or Buddhist. They were followers, and it was known as the way. So and I can't remember who one of the earliest philosophers that were studying the Buddhist teachings in the 1700s from Europe coined the terms. That's when the terms Buddhist and Buddhism first appears, because I mean, the Westerners, we label everything, it's just, we gotta label everything, and so they did. Now one of the first English translations was in the 1920s. It was the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's a very unique textbook. There are two English translations. Professor Robert Thurman translated one as well, but that's not. So when they translate it from Sanskrit or from Tibetan to English, There was not a Tibetan title, Book of the Dead. That's what the English translator titled it. So the Tibetans didn't have a book that said the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But it's a description of, you know, of rebirth and karma and so on. And it's a handbook for practitioners to prepare for their next birth when they get old. But yeah, so most of the translations from Tibetan to Sanskrit English start in the 60s, 70s.
I think that there's a retreat coming up. Are you all going?
I think it says September or something.
I don't know about that one.
You're talking about the calendar?
I don't know. It just said retreat.
There's a family retreat in the mountains.
Yeah,
Christy's doing that with the kids.
I should
know. Yes. I don't know. I'm not sure. We'll have to look at the calendar. Yeah, but so there's one of our members has a farm in Chatham County, Nolan's Buddhist Farm, and so we have retreats there. Sometimes we have retreats here. In Buddhism, in the Discovering Buddhism, there's a practice day or retreat at the end of each course. There's usually a practice day, and they do that sometimes on a Saturday where everybody comes here and has retreat. And that's just, there's just very little talking. It's meditation, it's, you know, short teachings, and then introspection and meditation. So I don't know of anything in September. Yeah, there's a family, I don't know what to call it, camping something.
Yeah.
Other questions? Because this whole last part I've left open for this, to try to encourage people to ask these questions.
I have a non-bright question.
Go ahead, Wendy.
No, it's really... What's the difference between the Buddha that you see in the stores?
Hodul. You're talking about Hodul.
Yes.
The fat guy.
Yes. That's big man.
That's not a, that's a monk. That's a Chinese monk from the 10th century. His name was Hotle. Hodul, and it was a Chinese name. He was a very generous, I don't know how he became famous, but he's just a very generous, gregarious. Children loved him. It was kind of like a Santa Claus figure. That's me talking. But so he was well known in his village as being a really happy, gregarious. And I mean, monks are beggars. So for him to be fat, I mean, he was doing a lot of begging. I mean, that's what monk means, is beggar. So they had the alms bowl, and they would go out in the village with their bowl, and that's the way they ate, that's how they were fed. And I'm assuming he was real popular. But he's in the Chinese restaurants, really fat, and he's doing, yeah.
There's other types of Buddhism,
you know, Vietnam, yeah. And China, and Japan.
Yeah, but he was not a Buddha. That's not a Buddha. I mean, people use that. My brother-in-law was in Vietnam, and that's what he uses. He's got, you know, when I try to explain it, he didn't care. I mean, that's what he learned. That's the way he learned, you know. It was in Vietnam. That's what they, that's
whatever
what
he
learned.
Thinks.
Yeah, it's his, yeah.
That's
yeah.
Fine, right?
Yeah. So, thank you for asking that. I've never been asked that before. Hodul. Or Hodul.
And this is just the modern Buddha. I mean, I know I'm not as familiar as I should be with the other Buddhas. Is the next one Maitreya? Or
that's the Buddha that will come when all knowledge of Siddhartha Gautama has been lost. Maitreya. So that's the interesting thing that people don't catch about the teachings on the Sangha. Those 12 years he spent in that cave, because he says that he was receiving teachings from Maitreya. And that's not a...
Time is relative.
Yes.
What part in the process of learning do you learn about his actual path, his history, his is there such a thing?
Yes. Yeah. You know, they didn't write the first... the first time any of this was written was in Sri Lanka in like the first century BC. So this practice was it was very old. It was a oral tradition. We know his parents' name. We know where he was born. It's in present day Nepal. He was married. He got married. He had a child. Yeah. And some non-Buddhist traditions are critical of that because he left them. You know, he went on the 6 years of living aesthetically, not eating, not, you know, depriving himself of food, to trying to force this awareness of understanding. And so he left his wife and child in the palace. Of course, as you know, he was born a prince. He was going to inherit that kingdom. I mean, that's what his father wanted, was for him to inherit the kingdom. And he rejected that, and I guess his son inherited it, is what, you know. Well, one of the... And Venerable Miller, Venerable Amy talked about it on her disc. She describes his life, something of his life. But his mother died soon after he was born. He was raised by his aunt, who became a nun. So women had positions of power in Buddhism early. And His Holiness has said if we have another Dalai Lama, we've got to deal with not having a Panchen Lama. The communist Chinese have kidnapped the teacher that is supposed to identify the next Dalai Lama because they want to, it's a political issue, so they can say whoever they want. But the Dalai Lama said there's no reason that the next Dalai Lama is not a woman. And Geshe's, we have female Geshe's, Geshe-mas. So there's, Buddhism is very non-discriminatory of gender, of any race. I mean, the Buddha, one of the reasons the Buddha was seemingly, was not a fan of organized religion was because the caste system in India, you know, your success in life was based on your birth. So you had the Brahmin class was the highest class of people, and then, you know, the people at the bottom were the beggars in the streets that had nothing, you know, crippled people. So he was very, very suspicious of religion, organized religion. So next Tuesday night, we're going to do emptiness. I've already done the slides. It's Chris's favorite topic, and so he's going to be here to help us out. So emptiness, this idea of emptiness is unique to Buddhism. A lot of these other concepts are can be found in Hinduism, Jainism, and Bon, rebirth, karma, and so on. But emptiness, this idea of how things exist, is unique to Buddhism and is original to Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha. And it will explain, hopefully, how things exist. Or at least we'll talk about it. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Too involved.
No, you're fine.
Seems to me.
All right. If Buddhism is, you know, godless, and my question is kind of this: I'm asking what they believe. I'm not trying to sound like a sharpshooter or anything, by any means.
Go ahead. No, I'm
okay.
Fine.
Do they believe? Does it teach something like, you know, this universal consciousness? In other words, how can the Dalai Lama tell me, you know, who you really are? Where did, or any teacher, or, you know, you read these things. The karate guy, Steven Seagal.
Yeah.
He was supposedly is somebody reincarnated and was told that. Now whether that's just something from People magazine or not, I don't know. But for another sentient being who's not connected to God or is not the embodiment of all knowledge, the repository of all knowledge in the universe, what does Buddhism teach about them having that awareness? That Brad Neal, you know, is
And I don't even know, I'm asking my own question.
Sure.
It's not that Brad Neal is someone else, or is it? Can they, are they tapping into past lives or a cosmic consciousness, a hive mind of all our consciousness?
No, not at all. It, so the implication there is that there is this essence of, is it Brad?
Yes.
There's this essence of Brad that might go forward to another life. And that's not the Buddhist concept at all. Brad is a label.
Right.
It's a label of what's, and we'll talk about that next week, aggregates, these heaps, five aggregates, form, consciousness, discrimination, what you like and don't like, you know. But Brad is only going to be in this life. The part of Brad that I'm talking to that is the housing of your karmic seeds, that's what goes to the next life. And it could be female.
Right.
It could be any gender, any race. And they say if you accumulate enough negative, non-virtuous karma in this life, that you may not be human in the next life. So there's not a Bradness that goes forward. So what we're kind of talking about is the difference between rebirth and reincarnation. Reincarnation seems to imply that the essence of the Dalai Lama has continued since the 13th century. And there's Lama Yeshe, supposedly has been reincarnated in Spain by Olse. O-L-S-E. He's now a film director. He attended monastery until when he was old enough, he decided not to follow in the teachings.
Well, that's what I'm curious about. Who knows that someone was reincarnated?
So real quickly.
The part about Brad is I'm just being somewhat of a vessel, and that was a name given to me at birth, and I've done a whole lot of things good and not so good that have all contributed to what's going on here right now. But
so the way rebirth has been explained, the way I understand it, when there's been these historical incidences of a child remembering a prior life.
Right.
That's apparently a fairly common occurrence. As those people that have a memory of a prior life age, that memory fades, and they don't recall it as well. And there have been several stories. When I've challenged teachers about that issue, they give me examples to read or do research on this person, that person, and the other person. So there's one, this child that had a memory of being a pilot. And told these stories about, and I can't remember all the details.
Right.
And they went back and they showed that all those things.
Should have probably described.
Well, he knew specific things.
Yeah.
And so as to the 14th Dalai Lama, he was able to identify rosaries, a cane, and I don't know what this Panchen Lama that saw him, that recognized him, and said this is the reincarnation of this man that died 20 years ago. I don't know. I don't understand that process. I mean, I know historically what they said this child recognized. And he was like two or three.
There are books that have information.
I've got books all over my bookshelf. I stare at them every day.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I'll be back here on Tuesday.
Thank you.